This is WMUK's West Southwest. I'm Gordon Evans. When Congress passed the Affordable Care Act in 2010, Bart Stupak, who then represented Northern Michigan in the House, writes, "I didn't quite realize I would be right in the eye of the storm." Stupak served in the U.S. House for 18 years, choosing not to run for re-election in 2010. He's now written about the health care debate and his role in it in the new book, For All Americans, The Dramatic Story Behind the Stupak Amendment and the Historic Passage of Obamacare. Bart Stupak will also be the keynote speaker on Wednesday at an event at Western Michigan University's Homer Stryker MD School of Medicine on the future of healthcare. Thank you for being with us.
My pleasure.
Why did you want to write the book? What did you think was important to get on the record?
The truth. you know, it was interesting. I was encouraged after the healthcare debate to really write down my story by some of the staff that worked with me, because there were so many things that went on behind the scenes that no one knew about. And we actually talked to a literary attorney, if you will. He said, "Well, you don't have an audience and you're nobody and the book will never sell. So don't waste your time." And then after I left Congress, as you said, the end of 2010, January of 2011, I went up to Harvard. And there I sort of outlined the book and what I thought would be an interesting book. And I let it sit. And the next 4 or 5 years, I watched the pundits try to explain the health care bill, the Affordable Care Act, which they were doing a very poor job of. And members, if you're for it, you're taking all the credit. And if you're against it, you're taking all the credit for trying to defeat it. So I saw a lot going on that just wasn't true. And I'd sit down, I'd write out a chapter or something, I'd set aside. And then what really happened was in 2015, early 2015, Harvard came to me, and I had completed a fellowship up at Harvard after I left Congress, tried to figure out what I wanted to do. I went up there, did my fellowship for 5 months, and I talked a lot about the Affordable Care Act, a lot about the value struggle I had, the ethical struggle I had, being a right-to-life Democrat, and at the same time not being able to get the Hyde Amendment in the legislation. And they came to me and they said, "You know, we always do a value and ethics course. It's required in political science. And we always used to do it on death penalty. But you know what? That's old school. We really liked what you had to say about the struggles you went through. Can you help us do a case study?" So we worked for about a month or two on a case study and ended up being about 30 pages. And right now it's a required course. Bart Stupak, The Man Walked the Tightrope Between Healthcare and Abortion is the name of it. But it's a case study in four underclass studies courses and one master's course program. And at the same time, oddly enough, the BBC was doing a program called The Obama Years. And it was a four-part series. Part two was just on healthcare. And they came to me and interviewed me once and twice and three times. And they said, "Everyone said we should talk to you because you'd tell a different, completely different story." And I said, "I know, I thought about writing it." And they encouraged me to write it. And actually, they went back to London and transcribed those interviews and sent them to me, which they never do, and just said, "Please, tell your story. You tell it well, and it's a good story." So that got me to thinking, okay, maybe there is something here. So then I wrote on weekends and nighttime. I still live in the Upper Peninsula of Michigan, but I work in Washington, D.C. with the Menable Law Firm. So I'd write on weekends and then suddenly, you know, about 2 years later, I had a book all roughed out, and we shopped it around. The fourth publisher picked it right up, and you know, we got the book published. The manuscript was published.
As you say, there's been a lot of things said about the Affordable Care Act now over the last 7 years. A lot of it is probably incomplete. A lot of it may not even be close to the truth. So I think there was a lot of people out there who, when we talk about the Stupak Amendment, may not really know what we're talking about or may have sort of a vague recollection.
Sure.
Explain what the Stupak Amendment did.
Stupak Amendment was nothing more than the Hyde Amendment. Henry Hyde of Illinois and Jim Oberstar back in the 70s put forth an amendment which said, and it was supported by Democrats and Republicans, that the federal government shall not pay for nor promote a policy or encourage a policy of abortion in federal policy, and they shall not pay for it with federal funds, abortion coverage. And that amendment had been around for like 32 years. And I've always adhered to the Hyde Amendment. Even times in 93, 94, we brought the Hyde Amendment to the floor. Hyde Amendment's always a one-year rider to the appropriation bills. So that's where the money is spent on the appropriation bill. So you put it on the labor HHS appropriation bill. And Hyde always said you could not pay for it nor promote or encourage abortions. In 93, 94, the amendment came to the floor. We voted on it, but we lost. The Right to Life movement lost, but we brought it back on 95. We won again in 95. And it's been on the books ever since. And all throughout my career, I've always voted for it, advocated for it. And 2009, President Barack Obama came in, Nancy Pelosi was Speaker, and Harry Reid was the Senate Majority Leader, all Democrats, all very pro-choice. And he just stopped giving us our amendments. So what really happened when it came to health care, even though and the book details all the things we tried to do to prevent this battle on health care, because I always felt abortion would derail health care. Finally, during committee, I was on the key committee, the Energy and Commerce Committee. We won the vote, lost the vote, won the vote, lost the vote that night in committee. And then it was always the Hyde Amendment, but the media, and because my name was on it, because I was the member at the time, they started calling it the Stupak Amendment. Stupak Amendment is nothing more than a Hyde Amendment, which says federal government does not pay for, nor promote, nor encourage a policy of abortion. And that was always a policy. And so it's nothing, it was what the law had been for 30-some years. It's been twisted so many times to say other things. In fact, I actually just watched an interview on Fox, of all things, the day after we passed the health care bill. And there they were again saying, no. Stupak Amendment bans all abortions in the United States. No women can ever get one. It was never the law. The Supreme Court has made it very, very clear you cannot ban abortions, nor can the federal government tell an insurance company that you cannot provide that coverage. All we can say is you cannot use federal funding to pay for or encourage or promote abortions. So it was just funny. I mean, even it's still misconstrued. But Hyde Amendment, Stupak Amendment, same thing.
I want to go back, though, to what you said there about that you thought that health care would be derailed by abortion. What did you think was going to happen, or health care reform was going to be derailed by abortion? What did you think was going to happen?
Well, all my years I've served in elected office, 20 years. For pro-life movement, you always had to have a counterweight, especially in the Democratic Party, the Democratic leadership, because they've all been pretty much pro-choice. And the counterweight in 2007, 2008, George Bush was in the White House, so he could counterbalance Nancy Pelosi as Speaker and Harry Reid as the Majority Leader in the Senate. So that was our counterbalance. Once 2009 came, there was no more counterweight. It was just a dedicated group of Right to Life Democrats, which was the only thing standing in the way from totally repealing the ban on federal funding of abortions. When we go together, there were always about 30, 35, maybe 40 Democratic votes with the Republicans. We could block any legislation we wanted to if we stuck together. And that was the hardest part, to keep everyone a cohesive group to vote together. And so anyways, in 2009, we just realized that it was a whole different ballgame. Throughout 2009, all the amendments we had, Mexico City language, UN population control, Mexico City, no abortions on military installations, the Hyde Amendment, every one were denied. We'd go to committee and we would testify in the House of Representatives. If I back up a little bit, there's 435 of us. Everything is accompanied by a rule. A rule says this bill will come to the floor. It will be debated so long. This amendment, that amendment will be in order. In other words, it will be brought, and you have like 10 minutes on each side to debate it, 20 minutes. So a rule really states and the way in which the legislation will be handled and voted on the floor. So in order to get an amendment, you have to go to the Rules Committee. Rules Committee has to make it in order. And we always had it. But 2009, they stopped. So you could see the problems coming. In April and March of 2009, before there was even a bill drafted, the Right to Life, Democrats and Republicans got together and urged the Speaker not to bring forth a legislation with the abortion issue in it, because you will derail it. Is that divisive of an issue? And common sense seems to go out the window when you start talking of emotional divisive issues. And so we did everything we could to prevent abortion being in the bill. But they ignored us because they had all the power. They had the presidency, they had the Senate, and they thought they had the House of Representatives.
And now, the Democrats at that time, Barack Obama's president, and the Democrats had the majority of the House,
and the Senate.
And they had the Senate.
We actually had 60 votes
right
in the Senate.
at the same time, well, for a brief time, because they had to wait for Al Franken's election to be certified, and then, of course, Ted Kennedy passed away. But I guess what I'm wondering is, how many Democrats were there that shared your view on abortion at that time? Because if every other Democrat is pro-choice, it would seem that that's pretty much game over, right?
Right. And it depends on how you phrase the issue. If you say, does a woman have a right to choose? Most Democrats would say yes. Then you ask the question, does the federal government, are they in the business to pay for abortion? Then the issue is no. Should taxpayer funds be used for abortion? The answer is no. Some of the most liberal Democrats have always voted that way throughout their career. And I didn't know that until I was forced to become a one-man whip team and did my homework and found who they were. Because after a while, remember I said the rule, when it came down to pass health care out of the House of Representatives, which was a public option, not this insurance exchange we have now. But anyways, in November of 2009, it came down where actually I'd reached an agreement with Pelosi to avoid the fight on the floor. And that lasted about 1 hour. She reneged on the deal. And anyways, I had to bring my amendment. And so the Stupak Amendment was the only amendment allowed in health care in the House of Representatives, which was the Hyde Amendment, which basically said no public funding for abortion, nor should the federal government encourage or promote abortions. And I had about 2 hours to get one. But anyways, we had 64 Democrats vote for it. 64. Everybody was shocked. But if you did your homework, and the way the amendment was so narrowly drafted that public funds could not be used for abortion, some of the most liberal members of Congress, like David Obey, my friend out of Wisconsin, head of appropriations, he voted for it. People were shocked. But you go back and look at David's career, about 30, 36 years, whenever that question was framed, like we framed it, carefully framed it in the Affordable Care Act, that there should not be public funding for abortions, he votes for it, even though he's probably considered one of the biggest pro-choice people there is. It's just the question. And should federal government, we're never taking away the right of a woman to choose. You can't do that. It's unconstitutional. But you can limit the federal government's payment of abortions.
When did you realize that you were in this very key position, that you could, you know, sway things one way or another, and that you were going to be someone who was going to determine whether or not the Affordable Care Act was going to pass and what it would ultimately look like?
Well, it's a position I didn't want, nor did I seek. But because I was a senior member on the Energy and Commerce Committee where the legislation is drafted, all the health policy and health representative basically goes through the Energy and Commerce Committee. I'd been a member and actually head of the Democrats for Life, and I was also chairman of the bipartisan Right to Life Caucus, which numbered about 120 people. So, I mean, I'm sorry, 220 people. So we had enough to block anything if you can stick together. That's always the hard part. So anyways, when did I realize it? Probably in the Energy and Commerce Committee markup about July 31st when CAPS brought forth the amendment. See, I didn't even inject the argument into the bill. The Lois CAPS, a friend from California on Energy and Commerce, I like Lois a lot, and I was surprised when she put forth the amendment to basically have Medicaid pay for funding of abortions, which would have included community health centers, which is a big deal in the Affordable Care Act. We expanded it greatly. Anyways, like I said, Lois brought her amendment up on in committee. Surprise, not that it came, but that she introduced it. Anyways, they won that amendment. And then the next amendment was going to be the Pitts Amendment. We had to cross out his name because they wanted a Democrat to run it. And I was the Right to Life Democrat leader. So we put Stupak's name in there and we won the vote. So we defeated CAPS and status quo, Hyde would apply. Well, through parliamentary procedures and rules of the committee, there was a revote later. And one or two people switched their votes, and therefore it passed. When I walked home that night, I lived about two blocks down from the Capitol, I vowed that I don't know how we're going to do it, but somehow we have to keep this status quo because it will destroy and derail health care. And I had many meetings after that with the Speaker and others trying to not get caught because all the good things in the Affordable Care Act, no one knew about. The whole focus was abortion. And who's going to pay for it? And that was the big fight. So I regret it. In November 9th, we had our vote. We won the vote on the floor, became part of the bill. The bill then passed in a bipartisan, the only time healthcare was bipartisan. Joe Gao from Louisiana, Republican, voted with us because of the life issue. and voted for the public option that the House put forth. And I thought, okay, good, fine, I'm done. Go deal with the Senate now. That's much tougher sell, the Senate, than the House of Representatives. And unfortunately, I got dragged in that fight, and it kept going until March of 21st of 2010.
As I went back and was finding some articles on the Stupak Amendment and healthcare, I found an interesting one in the Daily Beast, which was trying to get many people's perspectives on you. One of them was the former House Speaker Newt Gingrich said that you sold out, that Reid and Pelosi put so much pressure on him that they wore him out. At the same time, your Democratic primary opponent, who was planning to challenge you in 2010, said everybody is mad at him. Bill Ballinger, the editor of Inside Michigan Politics at that time, said that he thought that you were kind of an odd choice to become a high-profile player in the healthcare reform battles. As you had to be hearing all these things that were being said about you at the time. Was there something there that you thought, you know, that people were missing, that you thought that people didn't quite understand about what you were trying to do?
Yeah, they certainly mischaracterized the amendment. And both sides, the pro-choice side and the pro-life side, both used it for fundraising and for ginning up their base. So I really was a man walking the tightrope, as the case study says up in Harvard, trying to have these two values come together. The other thing that was important, and I'd remind my colleagues all the time, 45,000 Americans die every year because they don't have access to basic health care. So if you're truly concerned about life, and so do you vote against health care and 45,000 Americans die needlessly? Isn't that life just as value as the unborn child, or maybe even more value because they're here and contributing to society? That was the moral struggle going on. And those who were so opposed to me, such as the Catholic bishops at the end, U.S. Conference of Catholic Bishops, it was their number one issue. And at the end, when we're trying to negotiate a common ground, to find common ground, to find a compromise, if you will, not that you're compromising your values, but is there a way forward? When we did that, they all abandoned us. They wouldn't even talk about it, like the executive order. And I'd go back and remind Mr. Gingrich and my opponent and everyone else who had criticism of me. To this day, no one has yet pointed to how one abortion was ever paid for by the federal government. Now, they did bring out the contraceptive rule that did cause some problems. And I actually did a brief in the U.S. Supreme Court on that, on Hobby Lobby and Little Sisters of the Poor. I did briefs in support of their positions. But even there, that deals with an abortifacia, the morning after pill, not taxpayer money being used for abortion. So there no one can point to that. So when we had the executive order, which has the full force and effect of law, all my opponents said that's not true, but it is true and it has been upheld. So I don't think they want it to hear. The critical thing about Hyde and the Stupak Amendment, both sides for 30-some years were trying to make it permanent law, either for no funding for abortion or but funding for abortion. So for 30-some years, and the closest they ever came was in the Affordable Care Act. And unfortunately, I was the vehicle. The Stupak Amendment was the vehicle. And we had it in the House bill. But the Senate, we could only get 45 votes. You need 60. So at the end, you sit there and you say, do I want health care to pass, or do I stick my head in the sand, kill health care? And there wasn't no protections for life at all, because we never had the Hyde Amendment. We never received our Mexico Say language. We never received the UN. We never, our regular traditional writers, we never received. And so for 2 years, at least, well, it would have been 8 years because Barack Obama was there for 8 years, there would have been full-blown abortions paid for by the federal government. In the vitriol towards the end, they both lost, I thought, their vision and their moral compass. There was a small group of us, about six at the end, seven that really did not. And we were able to pass health care, and we still protect the sanctity of life, and taxpayer funds are not being used to perform abortions. And that's true today, as it was in March 21st, 2010, when we voted for it.
Did the reaction to the passage of the Affordable Care Act, specifically at you, you know, at one point, I think someone shouted baby killer on the floor of the right. House while you were speaking, you received death threats. Were you prepared for that, or did it catch you by surprise?
Having been in law enforcement and having been in some tight situations in the past. I wasn't surprised. I was surprised at the uncivil tone by other members of Congress. Remember, not only me, the baby killer, but President Barack Obama was trying to address the nation in September 2008, and he's talking about things and just yelled out, "You lie." I mean, and in each of those cases, the so-called innocent or outburst was all done for fundraising because they both set up websites to raise money off it before they'd apologize or do anything. In fact, Wilson never did apologize.
Joe Wilson.
Joe Wilson, Congressman Joe Wilson from South Carolina, I believe it is. But he raised over $1 million by doing that. And it's, I mean, politics has gotten so bad now, personal, and everything you do is choreographed to help you raise money. That's all dishonest, or I shouldn't say dishonest. It's all disrespectful it's become. Everything has an ulterior motive, which is usually money, which is not good for our nation, not good for the elected process.
Did any of that, the threats and the negative reaction and, as you say, the rather nasty atmosphere in Congress, did that contribute to your decision not to run for reelection?
No, that decision had already been made. But what it did do was reinforce it. On election night, November 2008, I told my wife, "That's it. I ran my last race. I'm not going to run anymore. We're going to pass healthcare, and I'm out of there." And so healthcare has always been a passion for me, as it's laid out in the book. And she just said, "Yeah, sure, we'll see." And then after that, John Dingell of Michigan was head of the Energy and Commerce Committee. See, if Dingell was there, we would have had this thing worked out. And Speaker Pelosi didn't think Dingell would move the legislation fast enough, so they replaced Dingell, the longest-serving member who has more legislative accomplishments than any other member of Congress you can imagine. And they threw him out like a dog and put Henry Waxman in there. And I get along with Henry, but Henry just has a different approach. And we are complete opposite on this issue. And Mr. Dingell didn't vote with me on this issue either. But Dingell can form coalitions and get legislation passed. And that takes a little time. And they're afraid they weren't going to move fast. So anyways, they replaced Dingell with Waxman. And that's all laid out in the book. And that reinforced it. To see a gentleman who spent 50-some years of his life, and he just came off an operation. He's an older gentleman at the time. He looked weak and feeble. And to go after him the way they did was just wrong. If they can do that to John Dingell, I had no desire to. I was about ready to quit right then and there. I had no desire to continue. And then the way I was treated by some of the pro-choice members just all reinforced it. So when all these threats and all the stuff you read didn't faze me at all. I'm not going anywhere. I'm done. They didn't know that. If I would have said that, I'd lose all my clout, all my ability to hold my coalition together as long as I did in order to pass the Affordable Care Act and to protect the sanctity of life by making sure there's no public funding for abortions. And if you take a look at my district, at the time, it was 600 miles long from Saginaw County line to the tip of the Copper Country, 3 of the 5 Great Lakes, 2 time zones. I was never... And I lasted 18 years. Most of them who have served before me, no one lasted more than 12. You just literally get burned out.
You have such a wide area to cover. It's a lot of driving, a lot of...
You can't jump on an airplane to fly to Bay City.
Right.
I mean, Traverse City, I live in Menominee, Michigan, which is in the central time zone. Like I said, 2 time zones in Michigan. And I look right across Traverse City, 92 miles. But I have to drive around top of Lake Michigan. It's 322 miles. So you just don't go out and give a speech on Saturday night at the rubber chicken circuit and get back home. You're there. I'd go to a region of my district and spend the weekend, fly back to D.C. There are times I'd not be home for a month in my home in Menominee. So, no, I'd had it. I had already made up my mind. I really wanted to leave with the Iraq War because I thought the Iraq War and President Bush, it was an illegal, immoral war. And I really wanted to leave then. But I didn't. I hung it out, and I got healthcare passed, and I'm proud of the accomplishments. And so when I didn't read the blogs, I didn't read all the stuff coming in. I was focusing on passing healthcare, protecting life, and that's what was important to me, and I ignored the rest of it.
So as we sit here and talk now, there has been all sorts of movement in Congress and in the Trump administration. At one point, President Trump not so long ago said Obamacare is dead, doesn't exist anymore. which would seem to indicate that now we have Trump care. But what do you think is going to happen? I mean, what would be your best hope with President Trump in the White House and with Republicans having both houses of Congress for what is going to happen with health care, at least through the 2018 election?
Well, fix it. Let's put in and actually that's the latest proposal that's been coming out of Congress. Actually, out of Senate, Patty Murray and Lamar Alexander, Republican and Democrat, come said, okay, we need 2 years to stabilize these insurance markets so people's premiums quit going through the roof. And I think that bill is going to pass. I've always said that even before they had this agreement. I knew they were working on it. Patty Murray had reached an agreement with Paul Ryan on the sequestration on the budget issues earlier, about 3 years ago. And Patty's a very good legislator. So is Lamar Alexander. If you get reasonable people, we work these things out. People who are not talking past each other all the time. So I think that's going to happen. But the Republican Party, remember, we passed the Affordable Care Act in March of 2010. November of 2010, Republicans took over, and they have basically killed it by, you know, cutting off the funding. The co-ops that we saw that went under, they only received 50% of the money they're supposed to receive. The individual mandate is now gone. It's still there. And if you don't buy insurance, you're supposed to get a $700 fine, but the Trump administration says, we're not going to enforce it. So no one's buying insurance. So who is buying the insurance? Are maybe older individuals who have some health concerns. So the poo has been, you don't have that good mix between young people and old people. And even the advertising and the information on the Affordable Care Act, you sign up, open enrollment goes from November 1st to December 15th. That's been cut by 90%. So they're trying to kill it by defunding the program, which is sad because part of the Affordable Care Act was Medicare Part D, which was prescription drug part, a very expensive program, that was passed by Republicans. And if you remember, we had a donut hole back then, you're paying in, you go, and it was a mess. It was a disaster. Guess what? We fixed all of that in the Affordable Care Act. There is no more donut hole. We paid for it. We fixed it. Democrats did. Look it. I may not like a law, but it's the law of the land. And therefore, try to improve it. Try to fix it. Every major social program we've had in this country, including Social Security and Medicare, within 12 months, they had to go fix, tweak parts of it. We've done nothing for 7 years. And it shows in Congress because why can't they repeal and replace it? Because they're inexperienced. They do not understand the policy concerns. All that's been in Washington is politics, not policy. If you look back, when we were there in 2010, when we passed the Affordable Care Act, since then, like 63 to 64% of the members of the House, of the 435 members, 63, 64%, we're not even there. They've never heard a meaningful discussion on health policy. They have no idea what they're doing. They have political slogans. That's all they have. On the Senate, one-third was not in the House or in the Senate. And again, it's all political slogans. Even President Obama had to admit it's a lot more complex than he ever thought it was. And it is a complex issue. We should have a meaningful debate. And we might disagree.
President Trump admitted it was. Yeah. You said Obama.
Did I say Obama? I'm sorry. Boy, no. President Obama actually understands it. President Trump even admitted it was really
complex.
Whoever
knew healthcare was so complicated was, I think, the exact quote.
Right.
You mentioned earlier that what you really would have liked to have seen was a public option rather than the healthcare exchanges.
Sure.
Do you see any way of getting there in the near future? Again, you know, with the political realities that the Republicans right now have control.
Well, again, not listening to all the pundits, when we passed healthcare in 2010, I said that probably within 10, 20 years, you're going to be in a single-payer system. It's just going to go that way. I mean, you just can't afford it. Government can't afford it anymore. Businesses can't.
Is that going to be better? Is a single-payer system going to be better than
what
we have
right now?
Well,
I guess we're all equal then, and we're all on equal footing. I mean, look, I tell my friends, from just a policy point, just think about this. If you don't cover everybody, then someone's getting taxed to pay for those who don't have it. And that's all it is. Healthcare is nothing but a tax shifting, cost sharing. And if not everyone's sharing in the cost, people are going to get left behind. Some people can afford it. Some won't be able to. The Trump administration, Republicans, have done a lot to give this Medicare for All movement a lot of momentum. And that's nothing more than a single-payer system. And most highly reimbursed medical expenses are pretty much pegged to Medicare costs now. So the Medicare for All isn't a bad idea. I'd rather see a public option in other words, tell everyone, okay, we're going to help you afford it, but buy your insurance. And it only exists as long as people are buying into the program. But this exchange program is not a good program.
Despite what you said earlier about Congress and what it became while you were there and how you knew that you were going to leave for a lot of reasons, have you ever thought or do you ever think about running for elected office again?
No, truly. I was truly burned out, and it's been great to be off. The biggest luxury is I control my schedule, and that's something I never could do before. And look, it takes a lot to run for Congress, and I salute the people who are willing to run for Congress. But I do think it's good to turn over members of Congress every now and then. I think it's good for the country. I don't think it's good when you do it all at once and always in one party's hand. But I do think it's good for to bring in new ideas and new people. I did my time. I'm proud of the work I did. I lasted the longest. I had the biggest popular votes totals. There's nothing more for me to accomplish or to do. I'm happy with it. I'm proud of my service. And I look forward to enjoying my time in private life.
Former Congressman Bart Stupak, thank you very much for your time.
Thank you.
Bart Stupak is the author of the book For All Americans, The Dramatic Story Behind the Stupak Amendment and the Historic Passage of Obamacare. And Bart Stupak will also be the keynote speaker on Wednesday at an event at Western Michigan University's Homer Stryker MD School of Medicine on the future of healthcare. This is WMUK's West Southwest. I'm Gordon Evans.